I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was hailed as the triumph of liberal democracy over communism and authoritarian government. Our guest, Edward Luce, is concerned that democracy is under threat today because of the economic struggles of the middle class and the inability or unwillingness of the elite and elected representatives to address their needs. He points to Brexit and the election of President Trump as signs that the middle class has lost faith in their political and economic systems. Luce is Washington commentator and analyst for the Financial Times, and his new book is titled The Retreat of Western Liberalism. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Edward Luce, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, reading your book, I felt first a great deal of pessimism about the future of democracy, and as I kept reading, even despair about the future of democracy. Is that your message?
No, I think, you know, the title, The Retreat of Western Liberalism, is slightly different to what my publishers wanted, which was The Collapse of Western Liberalism.
Oh, okay.
And I won that argument. Semantics, but quite sort of big semantics, because retreat implies the possibility of regrouping. I don't believe that the problems we face in the West, in America, Britain, and elsewhere, in terms of the well-being of our middle classes, are insuperable. I think we can address them, but I do think that our elites in particular need to understand what the rest of our societies are going through.
And I want to pick up on all of that, but let's set the stage. You write about, and it's certainly true here in the United States, that after World War II in the late 40s and into the 1970s, we really saw, at least if you were a white person, the growth of a middle class. What do you think was driving that, and what happened to change that growth?
So, I mean, after the Second World War, you had, as you say, these decades of real golden years for the middle class. I think we dominated the global economy, particularly America, but also Western Europe. We dominated manufacturing. These provided very secure jobs for usually single-earner households, where the male was the breadwinner and the woman was at home. And these jobs sustained the entire family. Not only that, they were well enough paid to provide those families with the ability to send their kids to college and themselves given the prospects of being better off than their parents. And that whole equation has unraveled really in the last generation because of the rise of others. The 85% of the world that isn't the West,
right,
is rising. And also, of course, the rise of the increasing intensity of automation and technology in our work. And both these trends, globalization and technology, really have eaten into the earnings of the middle skilled, the middle income in our democracies. And they are really the bedrock of not just the economy, but of our democracies. They're the center ground.
You know, I'm thinking about countries in Europe, and you focus in many ways on England or Great Britain. But thinking about how the middle class has been hit in recent years, even from the recession, and it seems that there is a larger safety net in Europe. I don't know whether that's true or not. Whether the middle class in some of those countries are able to weather some of the ups and downs of the economy better than the middle class here in the U.S.
It's certainly true of Germany. And I think it's no accident that Germany is the Western democracy least affected by populism. You know, Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor, is pretty likely, if you look at the polls, to win a fourth consecutive term when Germany holds its general election in September. Where else does the establishment get re-elected twice, let alone four consecutive times? And so I think Germany doesn't just have a stronger safety net, but it has a smarter one. We're not talking about paying a lot of people to do nothing. We're talking about an education system that trains people who don't go to university, who don't go to college, to do highly skilled jobs and to get quite well paid by those jobs and to derive dignity from those jobs. And I think we in America and in Britain, mainly in the English-speaking countries, but elsewhere, confuse going to university with being skilled. And Germany doesn't make that mistake.
Well, and I was even remembering during the recession when so many people were being laid off in this country that a lot of German companies figured out how to keep people on. Maybe they weren't going to work there 40 or 35 hours a week, but they didn't lay people off the way they did in this country. They tried to figure out how to hold on to them so that there would be less dislocation in their economy.
Absolutely. There is a sort of work sharing culture there that therefore means because those companies aren't planning to lay you off soon, they know that workers have all agreed they will just reduce hours instead of lose some of their colleagues. Because of that, those companies believe it's worth investing in the training of people that they employ, because those people are going to stick around. And that means those people grow their skills and also their loyalty to their employer. So it is a very different mindset. It's I think, served Germany very well in the last decade since the Great Recession hit. And it would serve us very well to study it much more closely.
Should we all be Germany then, or some version of Germany? And I ask that because part of your book is a thriving middle class is a key, a very strong key to a strong democracy.
Yes. I mean, and as the saying goes, no bourgeois, no democracy. You need a middle, and not just in the economy, but for your politics. You need a middle. You need a center ground. So, no, I don't think we should all become German. I'm not going to get carried away with my Germanophilia, if you like. But I do think that Germany has paid more attention to the sort of broad-based well-being of its people precisely because of its history, because it knows how vulnerable democracies are to populism and to demagoguery. And therefore, it's learned that lesson, as it should have. It's learnt that lesson very, very well. Whereas the victors in the Second World War, Britain, America, and others, I think we are far more prone to triumphalism and breastbeating and congratulating ourselves, and therefore to being complacent and to not seeing what's under our nose. And to be honest, the middle class crisis has been under our nose for a long, long time. Mm. This didn't suddenly erupt in 2016.
Well, what happened in let's say, the late 70s into the 80s? And, of course, today we're talking about this huge disparity between very wealthy people in this country, and not just poor people, but a lot of the rest of the country.
Yes. So, in the late 70s, what happened was the productivity growth that the United States had been enjoying really for most of 100 years of about 3%, 2 to 3% a year, really high productivity growth. That then slipped, and it stayed low, much lower, around 1% for almost the entire time since then, with the exception of the 1990s, a big exception, the internet revolution, the dot-com revolution of the 90s. And there you saw productivity growth rise, and therefore wage growth rose, and therefore there was a middle-class spending boom in the 90s. But with the exception of that decade, what you've seen is stagnation in worker productivity as we've automated and as we've outsourced a lot of our production to other parts of the world. And you've also seen the otherwise very welcome entry of women into the labor force, which, you know, has dramatically increased the size of the labor force. So what you find today is that median household income is not that much higher than it was in the 1970s in real terms. But this actually masks the fact that the median household in the 1970s was a single-earner household. And today, for the most part, it's a two-earner household. So the drop in living standards is actually much greater than what that number would imply, because these are two-earner households, many of them, particularly the woman, doing multiple part-time jobs to keep their heads above water.
But we're not going to not outsource, as I understand it. We're certainly not going to roll back the clock on automation. Women are not going to go back home. What's the solution here?
So I don't think that the solutions are that difficult to find. That's not what I consider to be the big problem. So one of the sort of central ways that we should be responding to this is something that I call a Marshall Plan for the middle classes. Mm-hmm. Namely, a big investment in lifetime learning, you know, from early learning, but through adult evening classes to continual retraining and re-equipping the middle class to give them the skills they need for the much more dynamic and transient economy of the 21st century. That isn't just a federal spending program I'm talking about, although I would call it an investment, not a spending program, in middle class skills. It's also employers in partnership with municipal governments and with other bodies. This is something society should be doing. So a Marshall Plan for the middle classes is one. I think another, which I label the New Deal for the gig economy, is to dramatically modernize and update the federal and state benefits that people, you know, have been getting since the 1930s under the New Deal and the 1960s under the Great Society Program. These are very outdated forms of welfare that don't necessarily encourage people to work, and in fact discourage some people from working. We need portable benefits, portable healthcare, portable pensions to take account of the fact that people aren't necessarily tied to one employer, that they might have many jobs. And so the solutions are not, you know, this is the sort of ballpark area that we should be debating. But we're not. That's the crisis. Is politics is not debating what's under its nose.
Well, that was my question about a minute before our first break here. Do we have a political system with the skills, the know-how, the willingness to address the problems and even create some version of what you just talked about?
At the federal level, no. Right now, I'm sorry to say that we're not. I'm based in Washington. I've been here for 11 years, and you know, I've never seen it this bad.
Really?
There is just no ground there for debating these kinds of pragmatic solutions, which require bipartisan cooperation. There is just no climate here for doing that. At the state level, yes, there's a far more, you know, America has these sort of democratic laboratories. You have the good fortune of having a federal system, which means, you know, all your eggs are not in one basket. So I do see at the state and city level and municipal level more willingness to experiment with the kinds of things I'm talking about. But I'm sorry to say Washington politics is, it's worse than gridlocked. That's a mild term.
And that is Edward Luce, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's Washington commentator and analyst for the Financial Times. And we've been talking about his new book. It's called The Retreat of Western Liberalism. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us much more after this very short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, Edward Luce is our guest. Again, he's a columnist for the Financial Times. We're talking about his new book, The Retreat of Western Liberalism, about the middle class that he says has paid a terrible price in recent years because of economic stagnation. And that, he says, explains the support for people like Donald Trump and for Brexit, the rise of nationalism. And again, you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9444. You write in your book that economic growth is really more important than values in holding this country, or I guess a country like Britain, together. How so?
Well, I think we tend to think that we are democracies because we're sort of more morally evolved individuals, that we're democracies because those are our values. Now, I think that's true to some degree, but I think we underestimate the extent to which democracy's worked and taken root because it's delivered the goods. It has always given the prospect, for the most part, that your children will be better off than you are, that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that we're all in this together economically. And I think we probably overlook the extent to which that's a really important glue that has held together our societies as democracies. And I think when that growth disappears, as it has for so many millions of people, then the ability to carry out calm, democratic politics becomes much, much more difficult. And the temptation to scapegoat others, you know, whether it's, you know, immigrants or Muslims or whatever, becomes that much greater. And of course, the opportunity for demagogues to come along and exploit that scapegoating, you know, gets far greater. And I think that's the condition, that's the situation we're in right now. And so it follows that really we're not going to get out of this unless we address the bread and butter anxieties.
Well, in fact,
of ordinary people.
Does that explain Donald Trump?
It does explain Donald Trump. I don't think Donald Trump is the cause of our problems. I think he's a symptom of what we've been talking about. Unfortunately, though, I don't think the kinds of policies he's looking at pursuing, particularly if you look at the contents of his budget proposal that he submitted to Congress a few weeks ago, I think these would actually take us further away from the solution than closer to it. They would exacerbate the conditions that led to his election, and by that I mean there would be a dramatic cuts proposed in his budget to education, to training, no sign of infrastructure investment that he was talking about in his campaign. And of course, you know, a very, very large tax cut, income tax cut, which by definition would go to the wealthiest income groups in America. This will make things worse, not better.
Well, it raises certainly expectations of people that voted for Donald Trump, thinking that he would address these middle class concerns. But if he can't deliver, what happens?
Well, I think those of us, you know, who don't feel a natural affinity for Mr. Trump, to put it mildly, are perhaps unaware of the how skilled he is at pleasing his base in other ways. And one of the ways he does it is by poking fun at the media, calling CNN fake news, New York Times fake news, and watching us lather at the mouth, foam at the mouth. And that trolling gives his support base a lot of pleasure. I think his pulling America out of the Paris climate change deal caused a lot of pleasure amongst some of his support base. And I think that his willingness to insult or at least sort of disrespect foreign leaders, and of course he's going on his second foreign trip this week.
I just watched him board the plane, yes.
Absolutely. He's on the way to Poland almost as we speak. That his willingness to poke America's Western allies in the eye is also something that caters to his base's idea that that America's been subsidizing them for too long, and these are mollycoddled, you know, overly pampered allies who need to stand up on their own feet. So Trump is delivering politically in ways we might not easily see.
Let me get Judy from Wilmington, who wants to speak directly to this issue. Judy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. I think that Mr. Luce is overlooking what led up to Donald Trump over the last 40 or 50 years. I've lived through the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, Watergate, and I can tell you that right after, or like Lyndon Johnson said when he signed the Civil Rights Act, I've lost the South for a generation. But the Republicans took advantage of these lifestyle issues. Nixon in particular had the Southern strategy and exploited issues such as the anti-abortion feelings of many, many people in this country to attract the voters away from their economic self-interest towards voting strictly on these lifestyle issues.
Well, that's,
and Trump is the apotheosis of that.
Well, then, Judy, it's a really interesting point, kind of turning a bit on your head, Edward Luce, what you're saying.
No, I fully agree with what Judy's just said. I think the Southern strategy, and I think that under Trump's predecessors, the dog whistle to Southern white voters who might have racist sort of undertones that has turned into a megaphone under Donald Trump is an absolutely key part of exploiting the white working class's feelings of resentment and anxiety. So I don't see that as contradicting my point at all. But what I would say to Judy, with whose every word I agreed, what I would say to Judy is we're also having crises of liberal democracy in other Western democracies, which don't have the same, you know, history of the civil rights movement and of the Southern strategy. There is something in common across the West here that is a sort of bedrock of what I'm talking about. Each country suffers from different kinds of populism, just like each, you know, unhappy family in Tolstoy's famous novel is different.
Right.
And America's is going in this direction. So I don't see a contradiction. I think Judy very eloquently reinforces my point.
Judy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, but picking up on the supporters of Donald Trump, at some point he's going to have to deliver some of what he promised. Yes, it's a great applause line to beat up on the media, and there are many targets out there. But at some point, aren't people going to want to, if not keep their Medicaid, to deal with the opioid addiction in their neighborhood? Aren't they going to want something from this president?
Yeah, you would have to imagine that other than the very hardcore base, the sort of Breitbart reading base, that there are people there who actually voted for Trump who voted for Obama. There are people who are just fed up with politics and who each time try and vote for the most outsiderish non-Washington person. And Trump isn't delivering to them. He isn't pushing through the infrastructure bill. He's not, you know, developing a Marshall Plan for the middle classes. And I would imagine they would look elsewhere. But, you know, then we ask the question, does the Democratic Party by then, you know, have a Bernie Sanders kind of presidential candidate for 2020? Because populism is not just showing up on the right. It's also getting stronger on the left.
Do you think he could have beaten Donald Trump for president?
No, because I think Michael Bloomberg would have run as a third-party candidate if Sanders had been the nominee, and that would have split the vote, and Trump might have won even bigger.
That is Edward Luce, and he's Washington commentator, analyst for the Financial Times, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. We're talking about a whole host of things, including his new book called The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Let me get Linda from Pennsylvania to join our conversation. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Mr. Luce, please give me your thoughts on the raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. What do you feel is the impact of raising it to $15 an hour, the impact on democracy, growth, and job creation?
Linda, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Edward Luce, go ahead.
That's a great question, and I'm guessing you're referring to Seattle in particular, yeah, where, you know, they voted to raise it a year or two back to 15, and of course Bernie Sanders had that as his national tagline. My first answer to that would be, it depends where you're raising it to $15. You know, if it's in Manhattan or in Seattle or San Francisco, that's at a reasonable living wage for people working in some of these very hard service sector jobs. If it's in Alabama, or Cleveland, somewhere where the cost of living is way lower, it could actually cause job losses and incentivize employers like McDonald's to automate faster because labor is becoming too expensive. So it depends where you're raising it. The general sentiment behind your question of having a higher minimum wage for working class jobs, I would strongly support, but make sure it's not too high because otherwise jobs will be lost.
Can we create a system where we don't have people that we call the working poor, which always just makes me slightly nauseous to say something like that. To work and be poor is a denial of a future.
Yeah, and you have in many industries. Think of truckers who've been made independent contractors. You know, they're not employed by anybody. They're responsible for their own health care and for their own pensions, and they don't get that support from their employer. It's kind of a modern plantocracy. Or you look at, you know, the Coca-Cola factory system in Atlanta. These are kind of modern plantocracy jobs. You're working day and night, and you still can't keep your head above water. This is why we have to have a much more updated and intelligent system of what I call the New Deal for the gig economy. We have to have support for people in work to make work worthwhile, because society cannot remain fair or even-tempered or productive under these kinds of working conditions. One final little factoid, because I find this really telling. Is 60% of American employees, and I'm sure this is roughly true for Britain, my own country of origin as well, 60% of employees need to request permission to take a bathroom break. That, to me, is not dignity. That is not dignity.
Let me see what Gary from South Philadelphia has to say. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I was wondering if the guest could comment about the concept of American freedom. Like, we fight wars and we say, you know, we're fighting for freedom and democracy somewhere else. And I'm wondering, is that freedom the freedom to buy whatever we want or endeavor with our hard-earned capital in this, you know, society? We can do whatever we want. So that's freedom. Is there something to be there?
Gary, thanks for the call. You want to take that, Edward Luce?
So freedom as a consumer, is a part of what being freedom is. I mean, there's an old, old philosophical debate going back to the founding fathers about freedom from and freedom to. And freedom from is freedom from oppression, freedom from fear, freedom from, you know, having an imposed state religion. Freedom, too, is the ability to do things, you know, one of which is a choice of what you spend your money on. But you need money in order to have that freedom. And so there are some kinds of freedoms that require, you know, other resources if you want to exercise them. And I think really it's the freedom to thing that we're worried about right now.
Let me quote some of what you write in this book here. This is under a section called Fusion. You write, "We really couldn't ask for a nicer elite, yet the effects of how they spend their money are hardly progressive. For all the emphasis we place on our multicultural cities, they epitomize our oligarchic reality. In the U.S., the more liberal a city's politics, the higher rate of inequality. The most glaring examples, such as San Francisco and New York, are demonized by conservatives as citadels of far-left politics." Can you expand on that?
Sure. Clearly, there's a global boom going on in global cities. And, you know, New York, San Francisco and others are at the forefront of this. People who live in downtown Manhattan, you know, or in Pacific Heights or wherever it might be, the Palisades, are connected with the rest of the world and are thriving. They're living in places that everyone else aspires to live, or many, many others aspire to live. They're tolerant. They're culturally diverse, they're creative, and they therefore attract creative industries, which are themselves profitable and global. Outside of these cities, we have a lot of poverty, and people who are locked out of living in them because they're just unaffordable. So the irony is, we've got the most tolerant, as I say, you couldn't ask for a nicer elite. Mm-hmm. We've got the most tolerant cities with Aspen values, but the most unequal places in America as well. They are the biggest manifestations of inequality of wealth. A majority of America's poor, for the first time ever, now live in suburbs, not cities. And it's much less visible, that kind of poverty. It's not concentrated like it used to be in the inner cities. It's easier to ignore. It's easier to screen out. And I think that 2016 was the revenge of the suburbs, in a way.
We're almost out of time here, and I want to put something else on the table, something you wrote recently in the Financial Times, and this is about President Trump's meeting later this week at the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany. As I said, we just saw him get on his airplane to go to Europe. You say optics really matter, maybe not the defining matter of these get-togethers, but the optics are important. What are you going to be looking for? Literally.
Well, yes, literally, I'm going to be looking for the body language between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump when they have their first face-to-face meeting on Friday in Hamburg. You know, Putin, you know, is a former KGB officer. He can read people's weaknesses and strengths very, very well. And he's going to be looking to read Donald Trump. And I think how he reads, how he interprets Trump in their meeting will have an enormous influence over Russia's actions in the coming months. And that's of great significant interest to us here in America, but also to Germany, which is holding its election in September, and which has had a lot of fake news spread in its news system. And so I think that's the most important meeting. But of course, the meeting between Trump and Angela Merkel is going to be very important, too. She's met him twice already. Neither meeting went well at all. Traditionally, an American president would treat the German leader as a friend and the Russian leader as a potential adversary. It doesn't feel like that this time. So let's see what it looks like visually.
And we're almost out of time here, but from the President Trump's perspective, looking at his body language?
You remember the famous handshake with the president of France, President Macron.
Yes.
Let's see, you know, is he going to give Putin a fist bump? I'm not quite sure. I should know whether Melania is accompanying him. But if there's
I just saw her get on the plane. I believe she is, yes.
Well, will she not slap his hand away when he tries to hold it?
So much to watch and talk about. Edward Luce, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having
me. You're very welcome. And he's Washington commentator and analyst for the Financial Times. And again, we were talking about his new book, The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Well, coming up after this very short break, we'll be talking about Chris Christie and Beachgate. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, by now you've seen the photos of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie enjoying the sun and sand at Island Beach State Park with his family last weekend. He had closed the beach when he shut down the government. In typical Christie fashion, he was defiant about using the park when it was closed to everyone else, saying he had a right to use the governor's residence on the beach because he's the governor and his critics are not. Even his lieutenant governor, who's running to replace him, criticized Christie, saying his actions are beyond words. The shutdown was about the budget and a disagreement between the governor and the legislature over Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey. Well, here to talk about the budget, I guess, and Beachgate, as it has become known, is WHYY's Joe Hernandez. He's a South Jersey reporter for WHYY, sitting across from me. Joe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marnie.
Also with us and joining us by telephone is Brent Johnson, and he covers politics for NJ Advanced Media. His work appears on NJ.com and in the Star Ledger. Brent Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want your opinions and thoughts. Let me play a short clip, and this is Governor Christie talking about the quote-unquote Beachgate scandal after the legislature ended the budget standoff.
I understand, probably better than any other governor who's had this job, what it's like to get a lot of attention. And that cuts both ways. But if you think for a second that what happened over the last 24 hours would bother me a bit or make me change my mind about the way I interact with my wife and my children, no job, not this one or any other, is more important to me than my relationship with my wife and my relationship with my kids. And, you know, shame on those people who wanted to make this as if we were taking advantage of something. I just don't agree with it and I don't believe it. And I, quite frankly, this is who I am.
Clear enough. Brent Johnson, I don't think people were arguing about his relationship with his family. It was where they were taking their time off and enjoying the beach, a beach that he had closed to the rest of the state. Do you think this will hurt him politically, what's ever left of his political career?
Well, he's already at 15% approval rating, and the thought is, how much further can it go? He even addressed that, you know, he doesn't care about polls, nor does he care about political optics, that he wasn't worried about how further this would take him. You know, there's been jokes around the state house, will this take him under 10%? But he only has 6 more months left, and it doesn't seem like that's really on his mind. And that's kind of always been Christie's M.O. He will do what he wants to do. And early on in his career, when he still had high approval ratings, people loved that about him. People liked that about Trump. And Christie was kind of, you know, pre-Donald Trump in that respect, in that he spoke his mind and people liked him for it. But now, you know, now that Bridgegate has happened and he ran for president, you know, people have a different opinion of it.
Well, Joe, I know you interviewed a lot of people for your stories about what transpired in New Jersey over the last couple of days. What did people tell you?
Well, the beach pictures of Christie on Island Beach State Park with his family certainly didn't earn him any fans that I spoke to. I mean, a lot of people were saying they just need to end this. They need to end the stalemate. And, of course, there were other people involved in the stalemate. Assembly Speaker Vinny Prieto was kind of pushing back against what Christie wanted as part of this budget deal, and he was kind of standing his ground, Christie was standing his, and that's what led to the standoff. But people were saying, you know, he shouldn't be allowed on the beach that was closed to the public if nobody from the public was allowed on this beach either, because the beach was a state-owned park. So everyone I spoke to was not a fan of what was happening in Trenton.
Brent, it was one of your colleagues at the Star-Ledger, Andy Mills, that took the photos of the Christie family on the beach. Anything you want to add to what he has said or what we have learned from that?
I mean, that what's interesting is that became the story. It really didn't have anything to do with stopping the shutdown or starting the shutdown. But, you know, in the age of social media and in the age of 24-hour television, that took over things. And some people were wondering if that helped bring a quicker end to the stalemate, mm-hmm. if that caused a loosening of the talks. But it certainly what happened is the other side of this coin was Vinny Prieto, who was the state assembly speaker, and he doesn't have name ID even among New Jersey voters. You know, no one knows who Vinny Prieto is, and Christie was blaming Prieto. But the problem is people know Chris Christie, and just naturally by name ID, everyone is going to blame Chris Christie. So that's kind of what happened.
Well, I saw that there was someone, you know, with an airplane dragging one of those signs across the sky, and it said, tell Governor Christie, get the hell off Island Beach State Park. Joe, that was something that Christie had said, I think it was Hurricane Irene back in 2011,
right.
People that wouldn't leave because this hurricane
right.
was coming, and he was saying, look, for your own safety, get off the beach.
Right, and they kind of turned that on him. And Brent, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Christie announced earlier in the week that he was going to be at Island Beach State Park with his family,
no matter what. A week ago, yeah.
And
that's his point, yeah.
Right, that he said this ahead of time.
Right.
But it wasn't really until this photo, this kind of amazing photo came out, a wide shot of the Christie family on the beach surrounded by no members of the public. But then farther down the beach on another public beach, it was very crowded. And it appeared like the governor was taking advantage of state resources when no one else could. And that's kind of what set off this social media firestorm around him.
We're talking about optics here.
Right.
Tweet from ATP, is Christie shooting for 0% approval rate? I'm curious, Brent, there are 15% of the people in New Jersey that like their governor. Do we know who they are?
They're diehard Republican voters, and some may be Trump voters who like the fact that Christie stood by Trump. There's a wide swath at the shore, especially, of people that like Donald Trump. I mean, it could be they really liked him from the beginning and aren't going to let go. They're very similar to Trump voters. You know, Christie was once really, really beloved. He was at 73% approval rating after Hurricane Sandy.
Right.
People loved his response to Sandy. So, I mean, there are good people who could still see him as that person who's just gotten people who may not think he was involved in Bridgegate. You know, and, you know, there's a wide swath who might just stick by him.
This all had to do with this debate or fight over this insurance company. This is, again, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey. Joe, And you mentioned Prieto. What was the fight about? What did the governor want, and what was the pushback?
Well, Christie mentioned in his budget address earlier this year that he wanted to take money, surplus money from Horizon, and use it toward state-run public health programs, specifically his anti-addiction efforts, which he has made kind of the hallmark issue of his final year in office. He wanted to take $300 million from Horizon reserves, which I think were over two billion.
Right.
Horizon said no. At first he asked, Horizon said no, and then he said, all right, well, I want a bill from the legislature on this. And there he got a lot of pushback. People called it a money grab, a raid of Horizon's reserves, and Assembly Speaker Vinnie Priet. That bill actually went up in the Senate, was voted on and approved, but Assembly Speaker Vinnie Prieto refused to put the bill up for a vote because he was opposed to it. And eventually they came to an agreement on it, which got the budget passed.
Interesting. I said these to you, Joe, before going on the air. That sounds like something a liberal governor would ask for, which is to take some excess money from excess profits or from profits and use it for, I think, opioid addiction.
Right.
Treatment.
Right. And he got a lot. I mean, a lot of that pushback was from Republicans who said they don't think this is right either. The bill that passed was really a watered down version of those demands. I mean, he didn't get the $300 million for state-run health programs. Excess money from the surplus is defined in the bill will kind of have to go back to policyholders in a way. There will be some more accountability. So if you take Christie on his word that the goal was to get more accountability for Horizon, the bill does that in some ways, but it doesn't do what he said originally that he wanted.
Bryn, I hate to put it in terms of winners and losers, but since Christie essentially shut the government down for a couple of days to make the point, did he come out getting what he wanted out of this standoff?
Well, he said at the news conference the other day that he did. He wanted some bill, even though it didn't bring him the money he wanted for addiction programs, to reform Horizon in some way. He said he got at least something of what he wanted. And all sides are claiming victory here. Vinnie Prieto says, I stood up to Christie, and, you know, we got a bad bill killed or diluted. Steve Sweeney, the state Senate president, says that he got the Democratic initiatives in the budget that he wanted because Christie assigned the Democratic budget completely as it is, along with minor changes. And Christie says he got Horizon reform. So in the end, everybody's claiming victory, but the public will probably still blame Chris Christie, simply because that's the name they know, and he already is at 15%.
And this budget deal, at least this portion of it, does it in any way, Brent, besides people that, I mean, who would it affect in New Jersey, this deal with Horizon?
Well, there was talk that if the money grab happened, it would lead to rate increases on the 3.8 million New Jerseyans who have Horizon as their insurance. But, I mean, you know, 3.8 million New Jerseyans, there are about 8 million New Jerseyans, so about half have Horizon as their insurance. So this will reform the company that has their insurance. You know, it's kind of a complex, convoluted bill. You really have to read it to get to understand it. It was a very obscure issue to hold up the budget. It wasn't like a fight over a tax. It was this strange issue that held up the budget for 3 days and caused parks and beaches to be closed. And luckily it all ended before the 4th of July.
An email from Richard. What gives the state of New Jersey the right to access Horizon Blue Cross reserves? Isn't it a private company? I don't know if either of you can answer that. Brenner, go ahead.
It's a nonprofit that was founded through the state in the early part of the 20th century. So there is some state oversight, and this bill will increase state oversight.
Does this tell us anything? We should say, Joe, that we're talking about a Republican governor and a Democratic led legislature. Does this tell us anything about the relationship between Sweeney and Prieto?
In some ways, Prieto has kind of come into the role of a foil to Christie. I mean, this isn't the first time that he squared off with the governor, and Sweeney has been on Christie's side. I'm thinking Brent might have other examples, but I'm thinking of Atlantic City. When Christie first wanted to take over Atlantic City, he had a certain idea of how it should be done, that the state would have certain controls over the public worker unions there. Police and fire would be able to kind of unilaterally do X, Y, and Z. And Sweeney supported Christie in a lot of respects, and it was Prieto who pushed back and kind of was his foil.
Brent, do you want to add to that? And we should say that Sweeney is the Senate president, but go ahead.
Yeah, there's bad blood between Sweeney and Prieto. It's often seen that Sweeney sides with Christie in a lot of things, and the Assembly, which is the equivalent of the House of Representatives in the state legislature, the lower house, has always seen as not being as important as the Senate, and Prieto has pushed back against that a lot of times. There's also a threat to Prieto's speakership. There is an assemblyman from Middlesex County, Craig Coughlin, who has already challenged him next year to be the new speaker, and the thought process is that Finney doesn't have enough votes to remain speaker. So there was a big backdrop on the history of the bad blood between Sweeney, Christie, and Prieto to this. So this isn't the first time they've all gone head-to-head.
Anytime we talk about New Jersey, especially over here in Pennsylvania, the name George Norcross comes up. Did he in any way figure into this brouhaha, Brent?
Yeah, I mean, his name was mentioned early on. Norcross owns a small percentage of a company that is a competitor to Horizon, and some people were saying, well, Norcross has to be involved. Norcross is friends with Sweeney and often makes deals with Christie, so this has to be a Norcross bid. But that kind of fell by the wayside. No one talked about that after the first few days, because it did seem to be this was really a battle between Prieto and Christie.
I thought it was interesting that the lieutenant governor, she did criticize Chris Christie over his beach behavior, calling his actions beyond words. She is running for governor of New Jersey. Joe, do you think that was she sending a message, you think, as to the voters in New Jersey?
It certainly seems like it, doesn't it? I mean, Christie is at 15% approval rating. She is his number two. So to succeed from her perspective in the election, do you want to be seen as tied to Christie or as your own candidate, as your own person? This isn't the first time that she's criticized him. She's done it before. But I think it was just especially pointed this time. A lot of people were spending the weekend going to the beach. A lot of people were really angered about this issue. And so I think she kind of tapped into that. But she has been, in recent months, distancing herself from Christie in some ways. Yeah.
Brent, do you think this whole Breachgate brouhaha is over?
I think it's, there will still be some jokes on social media. It may be brought up next time Christie makes a public appearance. But going back to Guadagno, unfortunately, you know, for her, she has to carry a lot of the baggage of this. And she's been trying so hard to back away from Christie after 7.5 years as his LG. And, you know, this doesn't make it easier.
And how is the race for governor of New Jersey going, Brent?
Well, right now, usually the race doesn't heat up until after the budget season's done. So you'll see the race become more public in the next few weeks because the legislature goes away for the summer, and suddenly we have this campaign. And it'll be an interesting fight. Democrat Phil Murphy is considered the favorite. But, you know, Guadagno is running a campaign based on tax reform. She said she's going to cut everyone's taxes. So, you know, that gets people's attention in a race when there's not a lot of name ID between either one of them.
Well, and taxes in New Jersey, Joe, is that's a pretty hot issue.
It's the issue. Yeah,
the
pretty
issue.
Much. I mean, property taxes are always the issue. And she says that she can cut property taxes in her first term, and if she doesn't do it, that she wouldn't stand for reelection. So it's a pretty big promise. A lot of people have criticized her plan for how to do it, which she's calling the circuit breaker plan. She wants to audit Trenton and find some savings elsewhere. But that's, yeah, she's promising to cut property taxes, which to any New Jerseyan who owns a home or owns a property is a big deal.
Music to their ears.
Yeah.
And almost out of time here, they did pass a $34.7 billion budget. That was signed by the governor. Do I have that right, Joe?
Right, yeah. Christie initially said that he was going to make some line item vetoes to the budget if he didn't get the Horizon bill, but eventually he did, and so he signed the budget with some Democratic priorities.
Joe Hernandez, South Jersey reporter for WHYY. Joe, thanks for joining
us, Marty.
On Radio Times. Brent Johnson, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And he covers politics for NJ Advanced Media, and his work appears in, NJ.com and in the Star Ledger. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.